Hey guys, real quick before we get started, Tuesday, April 16th, I'm going to be hosting a free webinar outlining exactly how we bought and closed on our most recent boutique hotel and how you can take advantage of the tightening Airbnb regulations and the 40 million retiring baby boomers over the next 7 years. So if you have any interest in buying a boutique hotel here in the next 12 months, you do not want to miss this webinar. Visit register.hotelinvesting.com to save your seat or go to my Instagram at rich_summers. And click the link in my bio to save your seat, and I'll see you on the other side.
You know how many counties there are? There's like 3,700 counties in the United States. Do you think these banks have a CRM that ties into all the recorder's offices?
No.
It's an antiquated system against a non-antiquated system. The bank is like hyper intense and smart, but the recorder's offices are like these little old ladies chilling there just transferring deeds all day long.
Yeah.
I can go down right now, next door neighbor, or even your house. You want to sell this house to me right now, subject to... All I have to do is have you sign a deed over to me. I walk down to the recorder's office. This property is mine. Deeds.
So you can do it in the same day.
Same day. Within 2 hours, I could have any property subject to.
Welcome to the Rich Summers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show.
All right, guys. Welcome to another episode of the Report. Today, we got a special interview. We are out here in Scottsdale, Arizona, about to host a free meetup at my luxury Airbnb, and I got a special guest. He is the king of subject to and the king of creative finance. He's got his own TV show on A&E. I got none other than Pace Morby. Pace, welcome to the show.
What's up, brother? This house that you guys have is so special. Your team is unbelievable. You guys are going to have a couple hundred people come in here and hang out at this property, and you could legit fit like 1,000 people on this property.
Yeah. It's good size, man. 1.3 acres. We got lucky with this one.
And it's the location is phenomenal. You're right on the golf course. You've got a house that's called a guest house that I think most people would call your guest house just a mansion by itself.
Yeah, it's up there, man. We got lucky with this one.
You guys did a great job. You told me when we were walking through that it does like 700 grand a year.
We're on pace for 700K this year. We got about 500K on the books.
$700,000 on one Airbnb. I have like 10 Airbnbs that don't do that combined. That's amazing.
Yeah, man. So for the listeners out there that aren't aware of you, you got the creative finance stuff and there's so much to dig into. But yeah. Tell me, what have you been up to these days, man? What are you focused on right now in 2023?
A lot of stuff. I mean, when you get into real estate, you start realizing that real estate is a gateway into thousands of other opportunities, right? So you get into the tech space and you go, man, why is it in real estate there's not a tool that solves this one problem? So you start focusing on those types of things and you go, if I could provide value to the industry and lead the charge on that, like, why is it that there's not one place, because real estate agents have this, but why is it that investors don't have like an investor MLS where all the wholesalers can put their off-market deals on a platform where cash buyers can go on there and it's like a standard 50 state, everybody uses this one thing. It's like the go-to. Multiple people have tried to do it. And everybody fails. And so we're attempting to do that, starting it in our sub-2 community first and then kind of blossoming out of it. We're in talks of a second TV show right now, which will be cool. We're thinking about doing a show for A&E, a spinoff of our existing show that would have me and Jamil traveling around the country and fixing other people's businesses instead of focusing on our own and going to the small guy that's like got two or three projects going on and he's overwhelmed. It's like, okay, well, what are you missing? So the show would be all about that, like finding people are having real problems and solving those problems every episode. I got a book coming out with Bigger Pockets. It's already hit the bestseller list, which is pretty exciting.
Dude, congrats on that, man.
Dude.
I got to pick up a copy.
Yeah, or just subscribe to the YouTube channel because I'm like this, the YouTube channel is really where like every day I wake up and that's the first thing I think of. Besides my wife, my kids, obviously. We also realized that creative finance is a challenging thing because there's title companies that won't do it. Or don't know how to do it, rather. Mm-hmm. And so we are starting a nationwide title company to do sub-2 seller finance novation agreements nationwide. That has already, we're already doing them in all 50 states. Oh, and my multifamily fund. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited about that. We're doing all creative finance in my multifamily fund, which nobody's ever done before.
Whoa.
It's called the sub-2 fund. So super excited. I got 10 other things going on.
Dude, I love that, man. What do you say to all those people out there that say like, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, don't get spread too thin, only focus on two or three things. But you're doing a lot of different things, a lot of them at a very high level. What's your response to that?
My response to that is you will not be able to succeed at spreading yourself too thin because you have the mindset of somebody that's trying to do it all yourself. What if the one thing you focused on, Rich, was just hiring generals for all of these companies to run these like a well-oiled machine? What if that was the one thing you focused on? So when people go, man, you have too many things going on. No, I have one thing going on. Mm-hmm. I come up with an idea and I hire unbelievable talent to run that idea as their full-time, like that's their football. They need to run it to the end zone. I'm disconnected. I just took the two guys that are following me around today. Mm-hmm. They came down to my office. We have a collective 600 employees. And so they came to my office. They watched me bounce around. And the whole time I leave after an hour and a half of being in there and giving them a tour of the office, I said, what was the one thing I said to every single department? And they go, as you left the room, you said, you guys run the ship.
I love that.
I don't run anything. I find unbelievable talent and let them run everything.
Yeah.
So if you find yourself being bottlenecked, it's because you are lacking the next person in charge. Like I never thought I would ever have a chief of staff or a CTO or multiple COOs, right? And so if you're a wholesaler or maybe just starting out as an investor, stop thinking of yourself as a solopreneur or an entrepreneur. Think of yourself as an enterprise. How can I be an enterprise? And that is all about the accumulation of high-level talent.
Dude, I love that, man. So I had Kara Beckman on the podcast yesterday.
Dope.
She's amazing, one of my good friends. And I didn't realize this until she mentioned that you were her contractor for her first flip.
I was.
Back in 2016. And I was like, Pace? And she was like, yeah.
Dang, it's been that long. What was that, 7 years ago? Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So I had no idea that that's what you were doing prior. So I'm curious, what is your background before you got into all the real estate entrepreneur stuff?
My background is probably very similar to your listener's background, which is your parents and the environment that you grew up in dictated what you did for a living. Most everybody's like, oh shit, yeah, you're right. I became a plumber because my dad's a plumber. I became a contractor because my dad was a contractor. It was like by default, it was in my blood, which if that's not a perfect equation for you to understand, you are your surroundings. I am not my own human being. I do not make decisions on my own. Unfortunately, I learned all through osmosis. And so I became a contractor and I was Open Doors first contractor here in Phoenix because I was using social media back, what is this, 13 years ago, something like that. I was using social media to show my before and after my construction business. Open Door goes on Instagram and pulls up hashtags of Arizona contractor. And they see me as like one of the only people posting on Instagram at the time. And they're like, can you come into our office? We're starting this little thing called Open Door. Bro, I blew up.
Like, I can imagine.
That year was the first year I made $1 million take home. So I was a contractor doing all their turns, right? So they'd go, all right, we bought 15 houses this week and I'd have to turn over 15 houses and get them back on the market. So I learned a lot of things. I failed a lot. And Open Door was really patient with me and very loving in my growth. And I ended up growing a company of 250 employees all around construction. And then OfferBad called me. And then Zillow called me. And I started flying around between Dallas and Vegas and setting up shop in other places. And probably towards the tail end of this is when I met Kara. And I was doing a lot of renovation for local fix and flippers here. I became the guy that was doing all of the fix and flippers renovations. And it wasn't until I think maybe 3 or 4 months before I met Kara that I had a woman come to me and told me that I actually was not a business owner and that I was a slave.
Some Robert Kiyosaki stuff.
Yeah. She, her name's Bethany, and she hired me as a contractor. I did two projects for her. On the third project, she says, hey, come do an estimate for me. And I show up, I'm 30 minutes early, and I'm sitting there catching up with text messages in my truck, like waiting for our appointment to start for me to give her an estimate on her new purchase for a fix and flip. She comes up behind me and knocks on my glass door and she's like, get the hell out of the truck. I'm like, what? She opens up my truck door. She pulls me to the back of my truck. She flips down the tailgate and she tells me to sit down and she's like pounds on the metal, like bum, 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 sit down. And then she grabs me right by my right shoulder or my left shoulder with her right arm and she digs her talons in me and she looks at me and she says, why are you not in real estate? I said, I am in real estate. Look at me. I'm doing all these flips. Look at all these houses I'm touching. She's like, you're not in real estate. You are a slave to my real estate business. You are a service provider to my business. So if my business doesn't buy houses, do you have a job?
No.
And I'm like, no. And she then says to me, you are as replaceable as a mobile notary. She says, you are as replaceable as a real estate agent. You are as replaceable as a title company. And then she says the thing that hit me right in the face. She says, a simple Google search could replace you. Guess who can't be replaced in this transaction? Me, because I own the property. I'm the owner. Everybody else is my pawn in my little chess game. Everybody's a pawn. I'm the player. And I'm like, gosh, damn. And I tried to defend myself, dude. I tried to defend myself, you know, as a guy, you know, this is, you know, years ago, early 30s. And I tried to defend myself. And she's like, how about you just shut the hell up? Damn. You're wrong. I'm right. And if you'll shut up for a second, stop defending yourself, I'll show you how to get into real estate. Mm. And that was maybe 3 months before I met Kara. And for about a year after I met Kara, I built a real estate investing company while I was doing construction. Because I still at that point, bro, I had done 7,000 renovations for other people before I believed in myself.
That's insane.
I believed in everybody else's business besides my own.
Had you not met that lady, would you still be doing it today?
I sure hope that some other angel would have come along between now and then. But up until that point, everybody was very, for people that are watching this, I felt like this the whole time, like thumbs on top of me. People wanted to control me because it's like a really bad employer will try and hold an employee back because they're like, I don't want them to realize how good they are because if they do, then they'll leave me. Whereas a really great team member and team leader of your company, you're like, I want you to become better. I want you to learn how to produce more income for the company so I can pay you more money and you can have some of this stuff that we're all building together. Mm-hmm. And so all of my clients, including Open Door, held me down in a way of like, we're not going to tell you how this actually works because we want you to solely focus on just being basically our pawn piece that we move around the country. And they would make me feel so great. And they did. Open Door is amazing. They would give me little bonuses and spiffs and they'd fly me places and they'd do all these things for me. I go, man, I'm the best contractor on the planet. And then Bethany reminded me, she says, I go, no, I'm the best contractor on the planet. She goes, that you saying you're the best contractor on the planet, saying you're the best slave on the planet. Mm. Bro, she might as well have just punched me right in the freaking face. It was so good and so powerful. And no, I would be so much further behind if it wasn't for her.
So you made this pivot around 2016. And what was your mindset at that point? Were you like, hey, I already know how to flip homes, so this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I actually, I was so dumb, dude. I didn't know what hard money was. I'm doing all these renovations. I was even having wholesalers 4 or 5 years prior to this go, hey, will you come on an appointment with me? I'm going to go buy a house and I need you to do an estimate for me while I'm at the house. And they would use I would do an estimate for them right there in their buy appointment as a wholesaler. And I'd hand the contract like estimate to them and they would show it to the homeowner and they were leveraging me to get the homeowner to come down on their price. I had no idea the connection there. Mm. I just wasn't smart enough. I thought, oh, he's going to buy this house and I'm going to do the fix. That's it. That's all I could think about. I was just too stupid. So Bethany pushed me to a point where I started sending out direct mail. I got a deal and I made 25 grand, a wholesale deal. It's one of the greatest stories of all time. And it really like opened up my mind to what real estate investing really was. Basically, the story of that is while we're sitting on the truck, she goes, how about you pull out your phone right now? And we're going to generate leads for your real estate business right now. I'm like, what? What real estate business? She goes, we're going to create one right now. She told me leads gives you a business and things to work on. And right now you don't have any leads. You don't have, and you're going to keep asking me questions about real estate investing. And guess what? You're just going to become an asshole. She kept calling me an asshole. She's like, unless you have a legitimate, literal problem that you are physically dealing with right now, you are just an asshole. And I was like, okay, great. And so she says, pull out your phone, generate, let's go buy direct mail to send out to homeowners. And I, of course, another excuse, like, I don't know any direct mail people.
Right.
She's like, you don't think I know some direct mail people? She makes me drop $5,000 on direct mail. I don't send direct mail now. And I send out the direct mail. 10,000 mailers went out for that $5,000. So 50 cents a postcard, basically. And I, about 3 weeks later, started getting leads coming in. And I missed the first two phone calls. Do you know why I missed the first two phone calls?
Because you're working.
I had my phone in my pocket. I was installing toilets at somebody's fix and flip. Mm. And my phone was in my pocket while I was installing where somebody was going to take a shit. That's how much I respected myself. And the fact that I just invested $5,000 into this business that Bethany was pushing me into, I was so addicted to just trading time for money. And then I end up getting this deal, which we don't need to go into today because it would turn into a whole 40-minute conversation about that, just that deal. But I end up getting a deal because I rehomed the seller's bunnies.
What does that mean?
Literally. I get a phone. The third phone call that came in was a lady named Janie, retiring school teacher. I go to the house, don't know how to comp, don't know contracts, don't know anything. Bethany told me, buy it for 150. I go to the appointment. Janie says, I have an offer at 165. I go, I can't even give you an offer. I'd be too embarrassed to even tell you my number. She's like, well, then get the hell out of my house. As I'm about to leave the house, I tell Janie, is there anything I can do to help you? She's like, yeah, actually, if you want to help me, what do you think you can do for me? I go, I'm a contractor. So I've got guys, I've got trucks, I've got people that can help you load boxes or load things up on the truck. And I always love my teacher. And she goes, you really want to help, right? And I go, yeah. So she takes me to her backyard and she shows me three Flemish bunnies. A Flemish bunny is literally like the size of a four-year-old child. And she goes, I have to rehome them. They're basically, I'm living on pension. I can't afford this. And my granddaughter brought them into our home. So I can't just get rid of them. I need to find somebody that can actually take them. I call my mom. Mom comes up, takes the bunnies. This is a, I'm shortening the story very quickly. And then I leave that day as well. Janie calls me. The seller calls me 2 weeks later and says, Pace, I met with 15 people before you and 15 people after you. And not one person asked me, where am I moving? Am I going to be okay? And do I need, more importantly, do I need any help with anything? You are the only person out of 31 people I met with that actually not only asked me if you could help, but you did it. And then you left my property with no expectation of return. I want to sell my house to you. And I'm like, I told you can't come up to 165 grand. She goes, whatever your number is, I trust you. Bring the contract. Let's do the deal.
I love that.
So I go up to the house. Bethany's with me. Bethany's the lady that, you know, forced me into this, told me I was a slave. She comes with me, shows me how to fill out the paperwork. Again, I didn't have to know how to comp or fill out paperwork to get my first contract. Well, meanwhile, everybody else is out there being assholes. Like I was an asshole. And we sign the contract, we leave, and I'm out in the driveway of this house that I just contracted. And I go, Bethany, what am I going to do with the house? I don't have 150 grand to pour into this thing right now. And I don't know like what it's going to be worth. And she's like, wow, you're dumb. I will buy the house from you at $175,000 and I'll pay you a $25,000 finder's fee. And I'm like, you could have told me to buy it at 165. I could have bought this at 165. She's like, but what would you have learned? And I go, well, what did I learn through that besides like pain and anguish of not buying my first deal? And she said, you learned how to find the bunnies.
That's so crazy. Literally.
Literally. She said, the bunnies, you, every seller you ever do a deal with, you will find the bunnies. And she says, this is why I prefer to go direct to seller, because no offense to real estate agents, but the agents are not easy to communicate with. And what is the real pain when a seller's going through foreclosure, probate, divorce, whatever the thing is? When you can communicate with the seller directly, you can really uncover what was really going on. And to bring it to a non-bunny related story, last summer, I bought a 43 unit multifamily in Texas. Seller's name is Mario. Mario says to me, you know, we called him up as an expired listing. Broker tried to sell the house for, or the property for $2.7 million. So we called the seller direct. We go, hey, saw that you pulled your multifamily off market. Was there something you weren't able to get on the market? He goes, yeah, $3 million. I told my broker I wanted $3 million. He couldn't even get me $2.7. I go, okay, well, what if I was able to come up to your $3 million? Would you give me seller finance? He says, maybe, but here's what I would do. I'll meet you. I want to make sure that I meet you in person and we can negotiate these terms. So will you fly to Texas to meet with me? I go, absolutely. For a 43 unit multifamily on seller finance? Sure. But he goes, just so you know, I want 20% down and 8% interest with a 5-year balloon.
Expensive.
I go, I ain't doing that deal. But I know how to find bunnies. And so I didn't go to Texas to negotiate. I went to Texas to find his bunnies. What's his motivation? Why is he trying to sell the 43 unit? And some people would be surface level and go, oh, well, he wants to retire. He's sick of being a landlord. Here's where the bunnies were. I fly out there, it's, you know, go to Dallas. I go up to the appointment and we're sitting there talking. I'm just not getting anywhere with him. And I'm like, there's some question I'm not asking where it's not uncovering a scale of this guy. I need to like lift a scale out under his skin and get underneath there. There's something I'm missing. And I look over his truck and he's got his son sitting in the truck, his 12-year-old son sitting in the truck. We get to talking about his son. I start asking questions about his son. Now he's starting to open up. And he said, I go, so, you know, tell me more about your son. He goes, honestly, I'm embarrassed to say I really don't know a lot about what my son is into. I said, well, why is that? And he goes, well, let me put it this way. Last year for my son's 11-year-old birthday, he asked his mom for his birthday, if you could just help dad love me as much as he loves his tenants, you'd make my birthday like the best day ever. Now we got bunnies. Now I found bunnies. So this is what I did. I said, you know what I would do if I were you? Why don't we structure this in a way where far beyond your passing, Mario, your son gets a monthly check every single month, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now, on his 62nd birthday, he gets his final check from me, $11,000 on his 62nd birthday, and that is a token of his father's love for his entire life.
That's so good.
And Mario goes, done, where do I sign? So I signed $0 down, 4% interest with a 50-year note. And what was the difference? The difference is because I found the bunnies. And so I could tell you thousands of deals I've done. We have 1,800 doors in our portfolio, and it was all about how do I find the bunny and structure and rehome that bunny. So with Mario, Mario sends me a text every time there's a holiday. Happy Easter, happy Christmas. You're my friend. You saved my life. Dude, he's not a scalable multifamily investor. He accidentally bought multifamily, which I'd say most operators, and like for you, boutique hotels, you're going to find, and you already know this, you're going to find a lot of operators that own 30-unit hotels, 100-unit hotels that are like in over their heads. Mm-hmm. They don't know what the hell they're doing. And you're going to be able to go in and gobble these things up on seller finance or even just really great prices because they're like, I don't know how to operate. Nobody taught me how to be a great operator, but I used my money from my CPA firm or my construction company, and I bought this hotel thinking it was going to be passive income.
Yep.
And then Rich is going to come along, buy that deal, turn into a boutique Airbnb, and you're going to destroy it because those operators, you know, can't be operators.
And a lot of those operators, the mom and pops, are retiring right now.
Yes.
A lot of baby boomers. And a lot of those mom and pops, they bought their hotel 30 years ago on seller finance. And so they're already used to it. Yeah. And so I'm like, man, this is such a big opportunity right now. I'm just shocked more people aren't on it. But with your seller finance deal there in Texas, similar with this space, creative finance, seller finance, it's out there. And like you alluded to, it's like you just got to build that relationship with the seller. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, it's going to put you in the top 5th percentile of all the buyers out there because 95% of the buyers, they don't think past, hey, what's the pricing guidance? Does this pencil? Why are you selling? And that's it.
That's it. And they again, I tell people, you just brought up the price. I tell people the price of something is never the value, okay? The value is what I can do with the property. So everybody else is fixated on the price. Like nobody could get the Mario $2.7 million on that asset. Meanwhile, I gave him $3 million, but I didn't come out of pocket. I'm letting his tenants pay down that higher debt. So I gave him a higher debt, but what do I care? It's cash flowing. I gave him we did a 50-year note. And I'm sitting there cash flowing on something while everybody else failed. And I would argue, you brought up 5th percentile, and I think you're being generous. I think it's like maybe 2% of buyers will know how to do what you just said.
Yeah.
It is the advantage. Right. Think about 60,000 real estate agents in Maricopa County, where we currently are right now. 60,000. Why is it that there are currently 700 expired listings in just the last 3 weeks in this county? Because those real estate agents don't know how to call those expired listings and go, hey, would you let somebody take over your payments? Or what if I could get you seller finance at the number that made sense for you? Would you let me go find a buyer for you? If I was an agent, I would be calling nothing but agents failures because I know that in the 1% or 2% of agents that actually understand creative finance, you could just clean the floor with all the other agents.
Mop the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy to think about it. So with the multifamily stuff, man, so, you know, king of subject two, and I'm curious, I know a little bit about subject two, but for the audience out there, listeners that aren't aware of subject two, what exactly is subject two?
Learning to become a successful real estate investor can take a lot of time and dedication, which some people just don't have. If you're one of these individuals, this doesn't mean you can't invest in real estate. My company, Summers Capital, is buying a bunch of boutique hotels right now, and you can invest with us in these deals without having to do any of the work. Our team sources the deals, we secure the lending, we take care of all the renovations, and we even handle all the day-to-day operations with our in-house management company, making it truly hands-off and passive for our investors. If you want to learn more to see if we can help you, go to summerscapital.com/invest to book a call with our team. Again, that's summerscapital.com/invest. Now back to the show.
Really simple. Let's look at it from let's say a cell phone, right? If I want to buy this phone, actually, hey, Rudy, how much did you pay for that A7? $4,000, right? What if I came to you and I said, did you get a credit card? Did you buy it with a credit card? Okay, so there's a credit card payment, I'm sure, on it. Okay, so easily I just go, hey, I want that camera. I'll just take over your credit card payment on that camera. That's subject two. I bought the camera subject to your existing debt on that camera. Seller finance means, well, it's paid off. I own it. Okay, well, let's work out an arrangement. I did this the other day to present in front of a stage. I go, who has an Android in here that doesn't want an Android? And there's a couple of people who are like, I wish I had an iPhone. I go, great. I'll sell my iPhone to you. How much would you pay for it? And they go, I don't know. $500. I go, would you buy it from me at $1,000 if I let you make $50 payments? I go, yeah, I would do that. Okay, that's seller finance. What if I have an existing payment plan with AT&T because I don't own this phone? AT&T is letting me have payments on it. Would you take over my payments with AT&T until it's paid off and then you get the phone? Oh yeah, of course. So if there's an existing payment plan already on it, that's subject to. Just means I'm taking over the existing payments that are already attached to it.
I love that. So what is the ideal seller for a subject to deal?
Typically somebody that actually has pain. So I look at seller finance and subject to, very different demographic, right? Seller finance is looking for gain, meaning they're very greedy. They just want a higher purchase price. Subject to sellers are pain. So it's pain and gain. And so I don't talk to sellers that are seller financing the same way I talk to a seller subject to. And you get a lot of people go, why would a seller sell to you and let you take over their 3% mortgage, right? Like I've got a 10-plex in Atlanta that I'm buying. The seller's just like, take over my payments. And I'm doing that deal with Big Boy from Outkast.
Where, no way.
Yeah, yeah. That's super cool. Super cool. And he even is like, why would people do that? Why would freaking people do that? And I go, because they're in a painful situation. They're going through a divorce. So here's the perfect seller for me in sub two. Somebody who's going through foreclosure, can't make the payments. It's obvious. Hey, why don't you let me catch up the arrears and I'll just take over the payments. Easy. I don't even give those 90% of those sellers don't get cash. Besides like maybe $1,000 or $2,000. We just bought a 2-acre parcel, not a parcel, 2-acre property with two houses on it, main house, guest house, on the ocean in Hawaii, 2% sub two deal. 2%, I'm taking over somebody else's 2% deal on the beach in Hawaii.
That's insane.
Divorce. So divorce, foreclosure, bankruptcy, a really big one, expired listings. Okay, so people that are like, right now, especially, you've got interest rates going up, which means the buyers who bought a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that are now coming, it's time to sell their house, right? They bought with a VA loan. In fact, here's a perfect list. You want a perfect list?
Let's hear it.
Go on PropStream, go on Batch Leads, go on one of these places and say, I want all loans originated between 2017 and 2022, the beginning of 2022, that were purchased on an FHA or a VA loan. Why? Because they barely put any money down. They have a lack of equity. And those houses, now that our market has gone down 16% and buyers are having a hard time qualifying for these homes, agents are having a hard time selling them. Mm-hmm. So I just come in and go, will your client, if I could pay your commission agent, would your seller let me take over their payments? And what's happening is we do on-market outreach originally to that same list, but the listings have to be 100 days or longer. Okay, so we'll call the agent. Hey, notice it's been 100 days on the market. Would your seller be open to us taking over the payments if we could get your commissions paid? 80% of agents are like, nope, my seller's not interested. They don't even bring the offer to the seller.
Why?
They don't understand creative finance. They don't want to look stupid. Mm. And I feel bad for agents because in real estate school, I went to real estate school too. You don't learn anything.
Right.
Nothing. Like even when I became a loan officer, you don't learn shit as a loan officer when you go to school. I was a loan officer for 2 years. You learn how to basically stay out of prison, but you don't learn how to run your business, how to underwrite, how to process. You don't learn any of the things until you're on the job. Mm-hmm. But you have a license to sell real estate. So as an agent, when you don't know something, but you're the licensed professional in a real estate transaction, it's embarrassing to say, I don't know what that means. And they go to their broker and their broker says, I don't know. They're internally going, holy shit, I don't know what that means. I've never done that. So their broker says, no, stay away from that.
Hard no.
Hard no.
Yeah.
So 20% of those agents are smart because they've been in the business for a while. And they go, I'd love to. Will you pay my full commission or is it a reduced commission? Well, that depends. Let's figure out what the interest rates are and da, 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 da. And then you work out the deal. And the agents, they say no. All I do is I just go, I'm going to wait until this listing expires and I'll call your seller directly. Like, we got a property on Anderson. Shout out to people that love addresses. I'm a very like much an address guy. 4034 West Anderson Drive. Okay. So this is a property I just bought. I closed on last week. We buy probably 5 or 6 a week. This is one I just closed on. We reach out to the agent. It was on market 100 days. Agent says, no, my seller's not interested. 120 days. No, my seller's not interested. 140 days, 160, 180 days, the last day of their listing. No, my seller's not interested. Please stop calling. Listing goes expired the next day. We call the seller directly. Seller says, you'll take over my payments? We go, yeah. And I don't have to pay you any money for that? Nope. We're not agents. We'll just do this deal direct. And so we gave they're like, do I get any money? I go, do you want some? They go, dude, I just don't want to make the payment anymore. We moved. The agent told us they could sell the house in 2 weeks. So we moved to Missouri to my job, my new job. And that property's been hemorrhaging 5.5 months of payments, vacant. while the agent didn't even represent your or send your offer. So now I'm turning into, bro, have you heard of pad split, by the way?
I have not.
Oh my gosh, pad split's so dope.
What is it?
So think about like A and B properties are pretty good for Airbnb, right? That's like where you focus A and B properties, A and B neighborhoods. But what about the C and D neighborhoods? You're like, damn, that's a great deal, but that's not an area I would want to do Airbnb. Nobody wants to freaking hang out there. PadSplit is a company that focuses on people that like, I can't afford an apartment or I'm traveling for work. And so what they do is they take a property, 3-bed, 4-bath, that doesn't not matter. And they basically turn the whole entire thing into a co-living space where people are renting by the week. Okay. They're currently in 21 markets. They'll expand to like 60 markets by the end of the year. They rent out each room by the week for $175. They screen the tenants, find the tenants, collect the money, do all the things for you. And so we've taken a bunch of our C&D properties, my single family stuff, and I've converted them to PadSplit. We've 3X'd our revenue. And I'm just like, why the, what the freak? This is so great. The ingenuity of people in real estate is so amazing.
Wow.
So that property we're turning into a PadSplit. And my payment I'm taking over is $1,800. I could rent it for like $2,400 and make a small spread. But we'll turn that into a PadSplit and bring in like $5,400 a month.
Dude, I love that. Now you just got to furnish the place though, right?
Yeah, so each room, the way PadSplit sets it up is each room gets furnished for about $450 from things on Amazon. So it's really bare bones. And it's just people that are like there maybe for, this is the craziest thing. I'm thinking, okay, so sometimes you'll have 7 tenants at the same house. Obviously, you don't want to do HOAs. This way you stay away from A and B areas. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what about the parking? They go, well, 50% of our tenants don't have cars. Okay. What about, like, there must be a lot of turnover in cleaning. They go, our average tenant stays 9 months. What the freak, dude? Where is this? Where was this 10 years ago?
Right.
You know, people That's have crazy. Just really figured out, like, the affordability in America right now has plummeted. And so people are like, I don't want to live with mom and dad. I broke up with my boyfriend or my husband or this or that or whatever. They're in a transitionary period. They're like, I just need a place to live that I can call my own, but I also don't have to shoulder the whole burden of a house.
Yeah.
And I can't afford an $1,800 a month apartment. PadSplit, $175 a week.
That's crazy, man.
Crazy.
So what's your take with the market right now? We got, you know, the recent bank collapses. Mm-hmm. The Fed's got all the control right now with the interest rates. But if you look at the fundamentals across most major markets in America, we got a shortage of multifamily housing. We got a shortage of single family. And if you look at the demand side from the demographic perspective, you got baby boomers who are, you know, they're not dying as early as they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. They're staying in their homes. They're not going into retirement homes. And then you got the millennials that are buying their houses. They're starting families for the first time. And then you get the Gen Zers buying them. They're moving out of their parents' house for the first time. And so you got this huge demand. And I think with COVID in 2020, and then now with this high interest rate environment, you know, the new builds are a little bit down from where they should be to meet the demand. So where do you see this kind of navigating over the next 6 to 12 months? And what's your perspective on the market?
Dude, I think at the end of the day, no matter what happens to our economy, the government's just going to print a ton of money, right? I mean, you see, even with what happened with the banks that were essentially collapsing, instead of just saying, hey, sorry, your money's not FDIC approved above $250,000, the government comes in and says, we're going to cover all of it.
We got you.
Well, then what was the use of all the rules?
Yeah.
Like, if you're just going to cover everything, great. Well, the government's telling me that no matter what's going to happen, you're just going to print money. You're going to cover people's bad management. And unfortunately, it was the government that raised the rates and caused those bank collapses. Those banks didn't do anything wrong. They made good, safe bets. They didn't plan on rates doubling or tripling in an 18-month time
frame. No one did.
Nobody did.
Yeah.
So they didn't do anything wrong. But I watched that behavior. I'm like, dude, look what COVID did. And look at all the, like, you know, these guys that are doing like ERC credits and stuff like that. Do you know about that?
No. What is that?
Okay. So PPP loans that came out, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
The government came out and goes, we're going to give $10 billion away on top of that to people through something called ERC credits. Okay. So what they do is they go, if you have employees that were with you in 2019, we'll give you $27,000 per employee from the government for free.
Wow.
This has been going on for 2 years.
No payback, nothing.
No payback.
Wow.
No payback. You just have to prove that you had some slight alteration in your business and it affected your workplace environment. They're giving away $26,000-$27,000 per employee from the government. It's just, there's full-on companies out there. You don't get these text messages?
No.
Bro, I get blown up by them all the time. There's all these people that are like, oh my gosh, there's brokers out there that are brokering this money from the government and they're getting paid a commission from the government to give you money.
Wow.
It's legit. It's like very, very legit. Pull it up. If you guys are listening, ERC credits, how to get them. Okay. I have nothing to do with it, but we tried to apply for it, but we got denied for whatever reason. And a bunch of my buddies are bringing in $2, $3 million because of all their employees. I'm like, what the freak? So government's going to keep printing money. You have a shortage of supply. If there's a shortage of supply and lending laws are incredibly challenging, you can't, like, you remember 2006, 7, and 8.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you weren't in real estate, I was a contractor at the time, and I was like, how the hell is my plumber buddy buying 6 houses right now?
Oh, and it was happening.
They didn't check my credit, man. They was just like a bank statement loan. Like, I just showed them I brought in some money. They gave me a freaking house. And so I got 6 spec homes going up. I'm like, a plumber has 6 spec homes going up in 2005, 2006. They were giving loans. They're not doing that. It's hard to get a loan.
Lending's not easy.
It's not easy. And so I don't feel like we're going to have a crash. I think that a correction, which is what we've really had in the last, 12 months, a settling in, so to speak, I think we've got some more settling in to do. I personally believe they're going to raise the rates 1, maybe 2 more times. And then I think at some point it's going to stabilize next year, somewhere around 5.5, maybe 6% on the high end. And that's going to become the normal rate. Because if you aggregate all the rates from the day we started tracking rates until today, the average rate is 8% over all time. We just got spoiled, dude, with 3%, 2%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these VA loans, I've taken over a couple of VA loans. They're like 1.75%. I'm like, what the
1.75?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I got one in my email right now that's 1.9.
That's insane.
And I'm like, buy the deal. Take it.
Yeah.
I get these deals almost every day. And I'm just like, people got spoiled. Now, I think it's just going to take a little bit of time. People are spending money like crazy.
No, they are. I mean, there's talks of a recession everywhere, but you know, where I live in my neighborhood, you can't even get a table to eat dinner on a Monday night. Like, there's lines at the door at every restaurant.
Shitty restaurants.
I get on airplanes. It's hard to get a seat on an airplane.
You want to get a first class seat right now? Good luck.
Yeah, it's tough.
You get to a point where you're like, okay, I've got time management issues, so I can't sit in the back of the plane. I got to sit first class. So you sit first class, so you can get off the plane, go do your thing and get to your appointment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you have to change a plane and get on a different first class flight, you ain't getting there. You're sitting in the back.
It's tough.
What does that tell you? People are spending money. You want to get a nice car, a brand new car? How about that camera? Was that just like chilling, waiting on the shelf, or did you have to order that camera? Was it back ordered? Yeah, it was back ordered. Everything's back ordered because people are buying stuff. Dude, the economy is fine. It's doing great. I think that if you become great at finding deals, and you've become great at having fun at what you're doing. Like, you and I were just talking about, where your focus is going a little bit right now, which is boutique Airbnbs, boutique hotels, turning them into Airbnbs. I'm like, that is not only amazing, but it's fun. And you're going to find deals no matter what market. Have you ever had a hard time finding a deal in any market?
It's so much easier to find deals in the boutique hotel space versus traditional multifamily.
Why is that? You think it's because people aren't doing it?
Way less competition.
People just haven't been educated on it.
And I think there's a hidden barrier to entry. It's like, okay, you got to understand the hospitality side.
Is it the mystique of it?
Mm.
Or they believe you have... Are you doing boutique hotels or boutique hotels turning into Airbnbs?
Boutique hotels that are zone hotel.
You're doing hospitality?
Yes.
Okay, so the hospitality side of things, people are fearful of it. Is that what it is?
I think it's an added layer because now you got to learn the guest communication, the check-ins, check-outs, all that sort of stuff. And I also think the price range we're playing in, 2 to 10 million in purchase price, it's too big for the individual investor, but way too small for the hedge funds, the institutional capital. And so it's that kind of sweet spot. But then also within the $2 to $10 million range is where all the mom and pop sellers kind of play.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know.
Where are you focusing? Are you having an area that you guys are trying to buy in?
Great locations right now. So we're focused on West Coast. Mm. California, Central Coast. We're buying a 24-unit boutique hotel right now in San Diego, 3 blocks from the water.
What is the pain point for these sellers? Is it that they've gotten to retirement age and they're like, we can't handle this? Or is it, we're not retired. In fact, it's the opposite. We've became a slave to this business and we don't know how to scale out of it. Because you know this, like a lot of our friends, you've scaled, you've hired great team members, you have amazing people on your team. We have a lot of friends that can never get past that point of like themselves being the bottleneck. So do you think that's part of it too, is that these hotel owners are like, I'm literally behind the front desk?
Yes. I think one, they're burnout. Two, they're hitting retirement age. And three, they're not caught up to modern technology. So they're not utilizing social media. They're not utilizing Airbnb, Vrbo, all these OTA booking platforms such as Booking.com, Hotels.com, most of them are only relying on their direct booking platform,
The traffic driving by.
Or the drive-by traffic. And so when you're doing that, you're only capturing a 25, 30% potential of your revenue there annually. But then you're doing all the work. You know, a lot of these mom and pop owners are, they're the ones fixing the toilets. They're the ones restocking supplies. If there's an issue with the guests, they're the ones that are taking
bunnies,
care of it.
Bunnies, baby. And so, bunnies. These are the bunnies.
Yeah, you got to find the bunnies. And I'm just shocked. Like, more people are not going after this model right now. You got a lot of people doing the Airbnb investing. You got a lot of people doing the multifamily stuff. Great. I love multifamily. I love Airbnb. I got a bunch of them. I'm just not buying them right now. But I'm just shocked. You know, we can go in and pick up these boutique hotels on seller financing. We can eliminate the expense of having an on-site manager. We don't need an on-site manager for 12 units. And then in addition to that, we can take the manager's unit, bring it online for additional revenue. And because it's commercial real estate and not residential real estate, all that added income drops to the bottom line and we can force our appreciation, which in a softening market right now is key.
Is your exit strategy on these to sell, bundle them up, do some sort of a roll up and sell them to a larger chain? Or is it to hold them long term for passive income?
That is one of our potential exit strategies. Our business plan right now with most of these deals, because we're buying great locations, it's hard to find these deals, you know? And so when you do find them, I don't want to just renovate them and then flip them. So our plan is to do some sort of cash out refi in year three and then hold these things long term, 10 plus years.
So you're thinking, let's syndicate. Let's say we go buy a $3 million deal and needs $1 million in CapEx.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to raise, let's say, $1.5 million from a syndication.
Sure.
I'm going to go 3 years, refinance, get my investors their money back, but keep them into the deal long term.
Yes.
And they got the majority, if not all, their money back.
That's the plan.
Love it.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not to say like, hey, once we build up a nice portfolio of boutique hotels, we have our own hospitality brand to where maybe we do exit to a bigger group out there. You know, that's definitely on the table, but it's not our first thought, yeah. If you would, you know, but.
Yeah, you guys, I mean, even just looking at this property, like the way you guys designed this property, think about like the vibe that you've created here. You do this, something similar to this in every hotel that you do. Dude, people are going to want to stay there. I don't want to stay at the Hyatt Place anymore.
Right.
I don't want to stay at these places. Like, they're nice, but I want an experience. Like, I live on this earth one freaking time. I want an experience.
It's the same reason why, you know, when we were growing up, our parents were growing up, you know, Chili's, the Applebee's, all these Johnny Rockets, it was very mainstream, but very popular. You saw them at every shopping mall. Every city had them. But now a lot of those places are not around anymore. The restaurants that do well are the ones that are unique and they provide experiences. And I think it's the same thing with these hotels right now.
I agree, dude. Wow. What a great model.
So I'm curious, what is the biggest deal that you've bought on Subject 2?
Biggest deal I've bought on Sub 2. We're currently right now buying a 580 unit in Houston on seller finance.
No way.
No credit check. Yeah, it's a $109 million acquisition. I have not closed on it, so I can't claim that one. The biggest deal I've closed is a $20 million seller finance multifamily deal in Springfield, Illinois. 256 units, 41 buildings, 256 units.
The Springfield deal, did you guys assume that loan?
Nope. That deal I bought subject to. That's the thing with multifamily brokers. Multifamily brokers are like, you can't buy things subject to in multifamily. Okay, great. You're the one that has a license, so you should know better than I do. I didn't assume the loan. I've never once assumed a loan, nor will I. Why would I assume a loan? Why would I go through the process of assuming your loan that takes 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and they're basically checking everything but my blood when I could have just simply transferred the deed? You could do it through a land trust if you're really afraid of somebody finding out you took the property subject to, which I don't do. I just transfer the deed into my LLC. That's as simple as that. We've owned that property now 8 months. There's a commercial loan on it that I took over sub two.
Now, what does that look like when you go to exit? Let's just say, hey, we got a buyer that's willing to pay this.
Yeah.
5 years down the road, does that bring the original seller back into the transaction because of the loan still under their name? Hey guys, real quick, I hope that you're finding value in this show. If you could do me a huge favor and drop a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you're listening on, it would mean the world to me. Also, if you know of anyone that would potentially benefit from this podcast, feel free to share it with them so we can help more people build wealth through real estate investing. Now back to the show.
No, you have a power of attorney on not only the mortgage, but also the insurance. The insurance ends up getting replaced with your own insurance, and then you add the seller on as an additional insured or as a loss payee, but you don't ever need their signature or their involvement ever again. I mean, we've bought homes. This is the fun thing. Probably 7 years ago, I bought my first home from a deceased person and I bought it subject to. So they had an existing loan. They had already passed away. I took their deed and started making payments on their mortgage, and the lady had been dead for like 8 months. the daughters that, this is what happened. The lady dies. She has three daughters living in the property. They couldn't afford the payment anymore. So they move out and they just go, we're just going to let the house go to foreclosure because they didn't understand probate. They're so silly. And you'll understand in a second why. They could not afford the monthly payment of $400 a month on this little three bed, two bath house. So they move out and they move into like their boyfriend's house and they just leave the house to go on the foreclosure list. I call, have a conversation with them. They go, we can't do anything with the house. We don't own it. We can't sign on it. I'm like, have you guys not heard of probate? Of course they haven't. They're not real estate investors. They don't freaking know.
Right.
So I take the process or take the house through probate, get them to be the authorized party. They sign the deal over to me. I buy it subject to, and I still have that lady. Now I have seven properties from deceased person people where their mortgage is still there, but they've been dead for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. In that situation, that lady's been dead for 7 years. I've been making a payment on a dead lady's mortgage for 7 years.
How do you overcome the hurdle of like when a seller is like, hey, the mortgage is going to stay under my name. Mm-hmm. How can I trust that you are going to make these payments on time and I don't want to have to worry about it and check in every single month?
Okay, a couple of things. So number one, remember that we are not calling just random sellers. We're calling sellers that are in pain and have bunnies, right? Mm-hmm. They all have bunnies. They all have something going on. And so they're motivated to do a deal with you. Does that mean they don't ask? No, they ask for sure. Number two, confidence. These are the stupid answers. I got good answers after this, but truly confidence. Like, you hear one of your students that make their first phone call and they're like, oh my gosh, I got told no. So yeah, because you're building your confidence. You sound unconfident. You sound horrible on the phone, but how are you going to get better unless you go through it? So you sound really confident. You sound like you know what the hell you're talking about. Takes practice, repetition, whatever. So here's the actual real answers, okay? So number three is we do something called a performance deed. So if I fail to perform on my agreement with you, the deed goes back in your name, house goes back to you, you get any down payments, any payments I've made, any improvement I've made on the property, you get the property back. You don't have to foreclose on me. And we created this thing, it's called the performance deed. So that's number three. Number four is I hire a servicing company for $17 a month. I use a company called Western Servicing. And what they do is they take the money out of my account 5 days before it's due. They take out the HOA money, the principal, interest, taxes, and insurance, any other things like maybe if there's a seller finance note, we call that a hybrid part sub two, part seller finance. Westar pulls the money out of my account, distributes it accordingly, and sends out an email to everybody associated to that transaction 5 days before the mortgage is due. Payment's been made. So you'll get an email and you'll know when I make the payment. They're like, really? And then I open up my email and I type in, like, if I go into my email right now and I type in Westar, I get probably 15 of these a day, right? So you get this little report every single mortgage on every single deal that I own all across the country, buying it subject to the seller is attached to this email as well. Everybody's
attached. Dude, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
so unique, they get notified before it's due. I always set up our payments 5 days before it's due. So worst case scenario, if I get abducted by an alien, you know, 5 days beforehand, the mortgage is due.
Yeah. And do they have insurance for, you know, because a lot of these residential notes, especially the ones that conform to Fannie Freddie, you transfer title or you do a subject to deal, they could potentially call the note due. Mm-hmm. Is there insurance for that?
There is insurance for it. It's called Equity Assurance is the name of the company. I've used them a bunch of times, but it is so not worth your time because I've had the due and sale clause called on me. I know the process.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yeah. If you're doing subject to deals, plan on it happening to you one every 1,000 deals.
Yeah, I've never heard of it happening to someone. I've heard of it, but I'm like, I've never met someone that where it's happened to.
Yeah, so we own a nationwide title company. We've done 10,000 subject to deals. How many due on sale clauses do you think we've had in 10,000 sub twos?
Less than five.
10.
Okay.
Okay, we've had 10. How many of them were personally my deals? Five. So let me tell you the first time I had the due on sale clause called on me. It's a great story. Lost Dutchman Trail. House is Lost Dutchman Trail here in Mesa, Arizona. Seller's in foreclosure, has $21,000 in arrears. Thursday, we catch up the arrears, wire the money to Johnson Bank. Friday, we transfer the deed. Okay, easy. Sounds no problem. Caught up the arrears, transfer the deed. I bought the property subject to. Mortgage stays in place. Well, guess what? The bank doesn't put the property back in good standing until Monday. And so the bank manager's in there and he's physically going in and making sure. It's a small bank, 6 branches total. They don't have like an overseas customer service. It's like literally the branch manager sitting down, going through a stack of foreclosure documents every Monday and going, who caught up? Who's still behind? Let's make calls to him.
Right.
He sees our file, 21 grand came in. He goes to the file to put it back in good standing. And he goes, oh, damn, the deed transferred. So they issued the due on sale letter. It comes in the form of a letter. Every due on sale we've ever had comes in the form of a letter. In order for a bank to call the due on sale clause, it has to go through a judicial foreclosure. That's the process. So it takes 6 months.
And that probably costs the bank money, right?
Costs the bank money. So 4 times out of the 5 that I've had the due on sale clause personally, and the other 9 times that I've had the due on sale clause called on me or called on all of our stuff, we just call the bank and the bank's like, oh, we just didn't know what the hell happened.
Mm.
Thank you. We just want the payments. So the one time it happened where I called the bank and we go, hey, we're making the payments. We caught up the arrears and the bank manager ended up picking up the phone and he goes, oh no, I see that. Appreciate it. Thank you so much. But that's bank policy. We're going to call the due on sale unless you do what some of our other customers are doing. I'm like, what are your other customers doing? He goes, oh, it's called an executory contract. And I'm like, oh, what? He says they're legal in all 50 states. In Arizona, they're called an agreement for sale. Some people will have known them as called the land contract, contract for deed. These types of things are called an executory contract.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is you're giving somebody ownership of the property, but the deed stays in the original seller's name until that person pays it off, refis it, or sells it. So there's no deed transfer in that transaction. So the bank manager says, so why don't you just deed the property back to the original seller, restructure it on an executory contract so you hold legal control of the property, but the deed stays in the seller's name. He's like, the due on sale clause gets called when you transfer the deed. So just transfer the deed back and then take control of the property through an executory contract. I'm like, hot damn, really?
That's crazy.
That's it? He goes, yep, that's it. So we deed it back and we reset it up as an executory contract. We still own that property today on an executory contract, but the deed stays in the seller's name. The executory contract gets recorded against the property, keeps the seller from buying anything, selling anything, refinancing, liens coming against the property, everything. It protects you. So why don't I just buy everything with an executory contract instead of a sub two deal?
Cost money.
It's way cheaper to go executory contract.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, way cheaper.
Really?
Why would I do it? Because when I have the deed in my name, I then can use the depreciation of having the deed in my name. The IRS won't let me claim depreciation or do a cost segregation unless the deed's in my name.
Mm, I didn't think about that.
So executory contracts are great to avoid the due on sale clause, but they're not great for my tax incentives, which is like at some point, it's like 60% of the reason why you buy real estate.
Right.
Right? Dude, I could talk about this stuff all day long.
Dude, it's funny because like a lot of people are worried to transfer title from their personal name mm-hmm. to an LLC because they're like, hey, the bank could call this note due. And another one,
name somebody, right. Name somebody, look online, give some guys, DM me on Instagram, name somebody with that's well, how they like, do on sale clause.
If I'm the bank, why do I want to get my client who's paying me cash flow every single month? Why do I want to get them in trouble?
All right. More importantly, who in the bank's department is even knowing that you're doing this?
Because no one's checking.
No, it's at the county recorder's office. They're not tied in there. There's no like CRM that's connecting them to all the county recorders across the, you know how many counties there are? There's like 3,700 counties in the United States. Do you think these banks have a CRM that ties into all the recorder's offices?
No.
It's an antiquated system against a non-antiquated system. The bank is like hyper intense and smart, but the recorder's offices are like these little old ladies chilling there just transferring deeds all day long.
Yeah.
I can go down right now, next door neighbor, or even your house. You want to sell this house to me right now, subject to, all I have to do is have you sign a deed over to me. I walk down to the recorder's office. This property is mine.
So you can do it in the same day.
Same day. Within 2 hours, I could have any property subject to without a title company. Now, I go through title companies because I want a title report and I want to buy title insurance. I want to make sure that the, you know, title's clean. There's no liens or things that I don't know about. But sometimes we have situations where, here's a great example. Seller buys a house, single family home. He uses down payment assistance. Down payment assistance specifically says that if you sell, transfer, or refinance that house in the next 5 years, there's a penalty, and it's significant. It's like $50,000 penalty because down payment assistance programs are trying to help people become homeowners for long periods of time. So they're like, hey, you piece of crap. We don't want you selling or refinancing this house within 5 years of us giving the down payment assistance. We're helping you become a homeowner, and now you're going and changing this all up on us. So there's restrictions to that. So if I buy somebody's house subject to, and they have a down payment assistance program, I don't actually go through a title company. I go directly to the county recorder's office and the deed transfers in my name, or we'll do an executory contract so nobody even knows that I control that property.
I love that. Another one that I hear a lot is if I take out a second loan on this property, is the lender in first position going to potentially call that note due? And I have heard of this happening one time, but it was a hard money bridge lender who was in first, and then the individual had pulled out a second, and that bridge lender's like, hey,
this is
not what we signed up for, and they caught it right away.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of these bigger banks that conform to Fannie Freddie, I don't think they're...
No, they're not looking.
They're not looking.
They're not sophisticated enough. I mean, you've ever called a bank to try and stop a foreclosure on a seller's home, and you get a hold of like people in the Philippines that don't even know like anything
know
about anything.
On.
It's like, what department? Loss mitigation department. Like even if you call the loss mitigation department, they don't know what due on sale clause even means. Mm-hmm. We had this deal I bought from Cody Sperber like 5 years ago. And I bought it subject to, okay, I went on the appointment because their team was still kind of learning. And I went on the appointment, I structured the deal, I paid them an assignment fee, and I knew I was going to flip this property within like 6 months. So I call it a subtail. I buy it subject to, I take it retail within like 6 months. So the month before I sell it, I'm calling the bank and I make a whole YouTube series out of this. I'm calling the bank. I go, did you know I bought this property and I did not pay off the mortgage? Could not get a hold of anybody that even cared. Due on sale clause is a freaking myth. Okay. Has it happened to me? Yes. Will it continue to happen to me? Yes. But I know how to handle it. And it's incredibly, it's like a unicorn. It does happen, but it's very rare.
I think that's like a lot of things we do as, you know, real estate investors, entrepreneurs is like, yes, there's a lot of what ifs, but it's like, until it happens, I don't need to know how to do it.
Right.
And when it does happen, I'm going to figure out a way to get 100% through that hurdle. 100%
of the time, right? It's like even, this is an interesting thing. Two things I want to say. On a 1031 exchange, I just learned something like 2 years ago that blew my mind. But the thing that you referenced earlier, like first position hard money lender doesn't want a second position private money lender, right? For pretty obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. They don't want the private money lender to be able to foreclose on them and then put them in a position they get squeezed. I get that. Especially during a renovation, because the hard money lender, let's say, issues a hard money loan for $200,000 on a $300,000 house, but during the renovation and the demolition, that property is now no longer worth $200,000 for a temporary period of time.
Sure,
because the house has now been demoed before it gets rebuilt. So I get that. I get in that off chance. So I have a hard money lender that we use. The name of the company is MyInvestorLoan.com. I do this thing with them. I go, I'm going to get a private money lender in second position. They go, please don't. I go, I'm going to do it. They go, please don't. I go, I'm going to do it. So I go, just like I do on all my flips, hard money loan from them, get a second position private money lender. And they go, okay, well, we'll let it pass. I'm like, because you don't want to go through the due on sale clause and spend the money because it's more trouble for you. However, it took me on this whole like mind chase where I go, what is the way to solve this? So I solved it with two different ways. Bring my private money lender on as a partner in my LLC, and his buyout agreement from my partnership is the loan plus the interest that I owe him, and then I buy him out at close of escrow when I sell the property. So he is not in second position. He owns the asset with me, and in the operating agreement, it says he could take over control of the asset if I fail to perform. So it actually puts him in a more secure position.
That's so good.
So good. Here's another great one. Let's say there's three ways to solve this, okay? So solution number one is having them partner with you on the LLC. Solution number two, I didn't know about this until like 3 years ago. You can have your seller file a UCC-1 against your LLC.
What is that?
A UCC-1 is a business lien. So I can't do anything inside my business financially without the person's permission who has the UCC-1 filed against me. So if I have an LLC that owns this house, a UCC-1 lien on my LLC will control that house. So now they're secured. They control the LLC that owns the house. What would you rather have? The second lien position or a UCC-1 lien on the LLC that owns the property?
The UCC-1.
All day long.
All day.
Okay, so that's solution. It's crazy what you can figure out and all this kind of stuff, right? And then the third solution, which you know is not a great solution for most. We're so deep in the weeds on this and people are like, holy shit, what is Pace talking about? So the third solution, which some people, this is not a good fit for them, but like, dude, I'm sure you have equity in this property right here. Mm-hmm. So if you go and you flip a house down the road, you know, median sales price in Arizona is 425 and you get a property under contract from a wholesaler at 200 and you're like, I need a $75,000 loan. I'll be in all into this thing, 300, 325, and I'll sell it for 425. Well, you get 75,000 and your hard money lender says, we don't want you to have a second lien position for the 75. Well, freaking put the lien on this house. You have equity here. Why not just lean it against another asset? Leverage another asset.
Even though it's in second position?
Even though it's in second position.
Yeah.
right? Because this is not a hard money loan any longer. You've refinanced this.
Stabilized.
It's a stabilized loan. And the lender here is not as sophisticated in terms of like deeds transferring and all that kind of stuff. There's always a solution.
Yeah. There's always a way, man. I love that. So dude, you're doing all this stuff. I know for me personally, like I always have individuals that I look up to and there's always another level. But I'm curious for you, like who are those individuals that you look up to right now?
The people I look up to are people that serve their community at a very high level. So like when I text Alex Hormozi or Layla Hormozi, and what I love about them is, yes, they're some of the smartest people on the planet. And you see Alex blowing up all over the place. One of the most intelligent human beings you'll ever see.
His content's great.
But what I loved about Alex and Layla more than all of that is that they used to drive around in his little Honda with a broken windshield and serving their gym lords community and meeting people in person. And so I'm like, for me, that's where I connected with them on. So it's like you right now, dude, you're doing a meetup and you're meeting people. Whereas other people that are influencers, like, no, dude, I'm staying at my house. I'm chilling. I'm going to vacation, vacation, vacation. I'm showing the lifestyle, showing the lifestyle. Bro, if you are an influencer, you don't deserve influence unless you have impact. And so what I tell people, I go, impact equals influence. Influence then equals income. And you have to be able to impact people. And what you're doing today is people are coming in and meeting you at this amazing property. I look up to you, dude. I look up to anybody that is serving their community and connecting with real people and not forgetting at one point you were also like, how do I get my first deal?
100%. I love that, man. Well, dude, it's been a pleasure, man. I appreciate you coming on the show. People are like taking notes.
What's a UCC1?
There was a lot of good stuff in there, man. But I appreciate you coming on, man. And I'm excited to go hang out with everyone here at the meetup. Yes. I can hear some folks filing in right now.
Oh, yeah. You guys got the freaking music bumping.
You got the live music. We got the hors d'oeuvres. We got Chef D here. But yeah, man, appreciate you. I'll be following your journey and I appreciate you coming on.
Super impressed by what you guys are doing and following you like on social media and seeing what you guys are creating. It's obvious you have intelligent people behind you, which is the sign of hyper intelligence. And I look at people trying to do this on their own and I'm like, you're going to fizzle out and then you're not bringing people with you. And the quality of the human beings that are on your team, bro, it just says a lot about everything you're doing. So super impressed.
I appreciate you, man. Team is everything. And shout out to the team out here. They are amazing.
Rudy.
Shout out, Rudy. I'm lucky to have them. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Peace.